Today, it's my pleasure to have with me Mike Wiley, who is one of the partners in Big Tree Hospitality. It's good to have you here today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You've had some really fun stuff happening in your life lately, not the least of which is James Beard Award.
Yeah. Thank you. It's pretty wild. I definitely never thought I'd be here doing this, and just won the James Beard Award.
Well, tell me a little bit about growing up in Hanover, New Hampshire. What was your life like back then?
I don't know. It was simple. Hanover was a really wonderful place to grow up. Dartmouth College sort of dominates the landscape there. So everything's pretty safe. You don't need to worry about crime too much. It's right on the banks of the mighty Connecticut River, and there are amazing rope swings. You could, swing out into the river, swim to Vermont, go to the next rope swing. It's a great spot to mountain bike, and skiing culture was really big there. So I skied a lot as a kid, and hung out with my little brother, and played capture the flag, and enjoyed school, and was a bit of a dork. Didn't play a lot of sports, but being a dork's cool now, so I guess I was just ahead of my time.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I feel like I missed that by a few years myself, but yes, it's good that you can like intellectual pursuits now and be accepted.
Not
for
feel
that.
Like a pariah. Yeah, it's
exactly.
Amazing.
Exactly. Yeah. You went on to Colby College, and you have a degree in creative writing.
Yep, creative writing and religious studies.
And religious studies.
Yep.
Why those?
I don't know. I mean, I always loved words, and English was much easier. It came easier to me. My folks were really good about at dinner, what book are you reading? If you don't have a book, then a book is assigned to you. And so it was just like, reading's big in our family. We're readers. That's what we do. And my brother's a really strong reader, and he kind of got the math brain. I was put in advanced math because, there was some wave of pedagogical theory that said, if kids are good with Legos, then they're going to be excellent mathematicians or whatever. And I was really good at Legos. But then when math got hard enough, they were like, okay, it turns out the Lego thing doesn't really apply. We're going to have to put you in the regular track math. But school always came easy to me, and I always liked reading. Reading was really the big thing. And then my father went to med school out in California in the 70s and got really into transcendental meditation and ruined lots of cocktail parties. And, he had me reading Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance when I was a kid, and Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh's Essays on a Mustard Seed, and all this hippie 70s nonsense. And I really thought it was fascinating. And so I took a bunch of classes in it when I was at Colby. I was really always interested in Eastern religion primarily. And I read about it in my free time. And I actually just sort of one day was at the registrar's office, and I realized, wow, I'm just 2 credits away from being a double major. I might as well take a biblical studies 2 or whatever the heck the class was. So I just sort of kind of stumbled backwards into the religious studies. But English was always kind of, my mother's an English professor. And I always sort of thought, ultimately, I'm going to become a professor. I like talking. I like words. I like the life of the mind. And I just sort of thought, yeah, sure, English, that's easier. When I got to Colby, I thought, I'm gonna be a paleontologist, because I was also absolutely in love with dinosaurs when I was in high school. Not when I was a kid. It was trucks when I was a kid. But I took the intro to bio course and was like, this is a lot of hard work. I am not going to do this. I'm going to go to English, where I can pontificate and I can skim some of the readings and I'll be fine.
What type of a doctor did your father become?
Anesthesiologist. He's since retired, but he worked at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center for 25 years or so.
And was your mother also a professor at Dartmouth?
No, she wasn't. She taught at, she was an ICU nurse, but she went back to school when I was in elementary school and got her doctorate, and she taught at Colby Sawyer College, which is in New London, New Hampshire, about 20 minutes from Hanover.
That's interesting that your father had this kind of hippie transcendental meditation thing and then went into a pretty mind-oriented subspecialty as a physician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mother's fond of saying he's anal retentive. He's very particular about everything, and I think that anesthesia lends its, I mean, obviously all of medicine does, but I think anesthesia lends itself well to that. He's always, he's very, very organized. He's since gotten really into cooking, and that attention to detail definitely comes through in Chris Wiley's cuisine as well. It's funny.
What did you like to read when you were younger?
Really, anything and everything. I mean, what did I love? I loved Jurassic Park. I think I read Jurassic Park 8 times. I crushed all of Michael Crichton's books. I read a bunch of sci-fi. I love this book called Ender's Game. I got into Stephen King a little bit. And then my father was like, oh, you should read It. And honest to God, for like 3 or 4 years thereafter, maybe even 5 years, I would like run past storm grates and sewer drains and flush the toilet and sprint out of the bathroom. It just absolutely ruined me for Stephen King. And so now with the remake coming out, I have like, I'm going to be confronting some of my demons. It's going to be interesting. But really, I liked reading just about anything. I mean, fiction primarily. Some of the Eastern religion stuff, the Ram Dass and Timothy Leary. I got into poetry when I was a little bit older, but yeah, I would say fiction. I was never a big nonfiction guy. I've sort of been exploring that a little more recently, but it was always fiction, novels primarily, and short stories. I loved, J.D. Salinger was like my guy. Not Catcher in the Rye, but Franny and Zooey and all this, the Glass family stories were the ones that really, really hooked me.
So I'm guessing that if you have a degree in creative writing, then you must have explored your writing side as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. To no great avail. I sort of made a practice and a discipline of it when I was living in Crested Butte, Colorado, where I'd get up in the morning, I'd get myself out of bed at 8, and then I would sit and type for 2 hours. And this was part of one of my mom's favorite teaching exercises to her English 101 or Intro to English classes is the secret to writing is writing. You just need to sit there and do it. So every morning or every class, they would start with 20 minutes of sustained writing where you could just write on your keyboard, I'm writing, I'm writing, I'm writing, I'm writing. But as long as you were generating words, then you were okay. It's just like this exercise in logorrhea, just constantly producing words and putting them on a page. And so I did that for a while, and I would write for 2 hours every morning, and I enjoyed it, and I think it was just sort of a nice way to organize my brain. I wasn't like working on a novel or anything like that. It was more just kind of reacting to my day and what I was thinking about and things like that. So I haven't really, it's almost funny that I studied creative writing. I think the literary theory stuff appealed to me more. All those classes in theory I thought were much cooler, and sort of trying to decipher crazy, nonsensical contemporary American poetry, that appealed to me more, like code breaking or something like that.
So it's really the understanding of the writing and the writer.
Yeah, the writer a little less so. I was always just sort of interested. I love the idea that like structuralism, that like whatever's on the page, that's what matters. Like it's, you can expand that to be like, oh well, you know, they were abused as a kid, and so maybe this you know, the psychoanalytical critique. But I never thought, I don't know, that never drew me that much. I like much more of the what does this symbol signify, and da 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 da, and are there recurring themes. And I really liked writing essays in college. I really enjoyed the fact that every single, or almost every single English department assignment was read this and then write about it. And that was it. It wasn't like pick 5 themes and discuss why these themes are. Even if that was the assignment, you could always turn it into whatever the hell you wanted. And that's what appealed to me about English.
You spent 5 months in Nepal.
Yeah.
What were you doing out there?
So I was an idiot. I did a really good job in my foreign language classes. I was in advanced Spanish and advanced French when I graduated high school. And if I wasn't a moron, I could have just taken whatever the test is to prove that you're competent or capable. And I could have proed out of taking any foreign language classes. But of course, I only figured that out until like my sophomore. I didn't figure it out until halfway through my sophomore year. And I realized like, oh man, I don't think I could take that class and or take that test and do as well. So how can I avoid taking classes in a foreign language? And Colby offered a program that was run by Pitzer College out in California, which was an amazing program. It was a foreign language program, and it's total immersion, and they sort of take this idea that, you know, some people are fond of saying, like me, like, oh, I'm not good at math, or, oh, I'm not good at foreign languages, and they were just like, no, that's not something we believe. Everybody is good at foreign languages. You just need to be in the right situation and the right setting with the right people, and so it was this fully immersive, you're going to live with a Nepali family who doesn't speak any English for 4 months, and you're going to attend 6 hours of language classes every day where it's going to be you and two other American students and one Nepali instructor who won't speak any English to you or very little English to you. And it was just sort of a trial by fire. They'd send us out into markets and be like, you need to go and buy two bunches of bananas. And we would just barely know how to say bananas. And it was just an exercise in, like, you know, feeling social pressure and humiliation. You know, like, you, I don't know how many times I deeply offended people by my behavior before. I was, oh, that is not done. You don't aim the soles of your feet at people. That's incredibly rude. But it was amazing. I mean, they had all of us, every single one of us in the program, were chattering away in Nepali, arguing with cab drivers. And then the last month of the program was our independent study. And we could pretty much decide to do, you know, whatever, study whatever aspect of Nepali culture or society that we wanted to. And I decided to study yak herding culture in the Solokumbu Valley, which is kind of a valley over from Mount Everest. And it was amazing. I had my rock climbing shoes with me, and I just bouldered, climbing like smallish boulders in huge glacial moraines at like 13,000 feet, and ate rice and lentils and got up really early and went to bed really early. And yeah, it was amazing. When I came back to America, I could like sprint for miles. And of course, you know, you lose that in a week or 4 days or something like that. But I felt like a superhero there for a little while. But it was an amazing experience. Nepal is an incredibly beautiful country. It's so simple, and almost without exception, everybody I met was just very warm, and I got a great sweater out of it that Andrew Taylor is fond of making fun of. It's like a Cosby sweater. It's all these hideous colors and patterns, but it's made of yak fur, and it cost $2.50.
How did you make the transition over to Colorado?
Rock climbing and skiing. My infinitely more mature and well-organized college girlfriend realized graduation was coming up, and I didn't have a plan because I was, you know, smoking weed and reading, you know, scripture and, you know, being a, you know, kind of a hippy-dippy college guy. And she was like, why don't we go and we'll go out west someplace, and you can ski and climb, and I can think about nursing school or something. And I said, sure, yeah, that's great. So I got my first real kitchen job, because she wrangled employment for us at Elk Creek Lodge in Meeker, Colorado. And Meeker, Colorado is like in the middle of nowhere. It's like not mountains, Colorado. It's like high step cowboy country, Colorado. The grocery store in Meeker, all, above all the shelves are just taxidermied elk and animals. It's crazy. But it was this really swanky fishing and hunting lodge that, you know, costs like $5,000 for 4 days and five nights. And the food is really fantastic. And, you know, it's an open bar the whole time. And, you know, you can pretty much do whatever the heck you want. And I was hired as a bartender. And then quickly, like with the Legos, they were like, you're not any good at this at all. We thought that anybody could do this, but it turns out you're the exception to the rule. And the chef of the place turned out to be kind of a head case. So they promoted the sous chef to the head chef position. And he was like, I need somebody. I can't do all this myself. And he and I got along reasonably well. And I proved to be a relatively apt pupil. And he showed me a few things. And it was great, because my first cooking job, I got to, you know, work with truffles and really incredible beef and local vegetables. It was awesome. I sort of got to skip all the, you know, flipping burgers or working the egg station through brunch service and things like that. So, yeah, it was great. That was sort of my intro to cooking.
What about this rhetoric degree that you got, this graduate degree? I'm kind of interested in this because, first of all, I don't really know what that means.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure Like, where does this fit in your schema?
So I was a ski bum and kind of a climbing bum for like almost 5 years. I lived in Salt Lake City. I lived in, I spent most of my time in Crested Butte, Colorado, which is like the most beautiful place in the world. And I always sort of, in the back of my mind, thought that I was going to be a professor and living in Ski Town, USA. You know, you can have your weird daily 2-hour writing discipline, but, you know, most of the conversation tends towards what's the snowpack like, what mountain bike trails have just opened, are they too muddy, yada, yada, yada. What's the camber on the new Vocal Gotama ski like this year? And I sort of, I was missing school, and I was missing having some more kind of academic style discussions. So I applied to this program at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and I was accepted. And I was sort of trying to think a little strategically about finding a job, because, you know, you get your PhD in English and it's like, hey, congratulations, now what are you gonna do? There are not a lot of jobs for English professors, and there are a whole lot of English English PhDs, and there are a lot of English PhDs out there. So I sort of started doing some research about how I could differentiate myself, and you know, English is sort of this broader rubric that you could filter down into a handful of different disciplines. And as I was saying earlier, I really love the kind of literary theory and almost philosophical aspects of language and composition. And I knew that, you know, I wasn't about to be doing, you know, any kind of hardcore semantics, which is almost like mathematics or logic problems, and rhetoric, which is basically the study of argumentation and the appearance of truth. Not truth itself, but its appearance. I sort of thought, oh, well, the skills that I honed is maybe an aggressive word here, but the skills that I sought to cultivate in college, they could apply well to this. And at the time when I was reading about rhetoric and I started reading some academic papers, you know, people were applying rhetorical theory to things like Ridley Scott's Aliens. I got this idea to write a paper on the Ghostbusters films. I never actually did it, but people were looking at the rhetoric of architecture and of public spaces, and how that big reflective bean sculpture in, I can't remember the name of the park in downtown Chicago. It's enormous. It's like, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's like, you know, 100 feet tall or something like that. And people just walk up to it and they want to touch it. And it's this amazing communal thing. And, you know, there were people writing about, you know, the rhetorical affect of that object and what it does is how it forces us all to kind of come together and kind of confront each other. And I don't know, some of it, like with all academia, some of it kind of spirals out of control or disappears up its own rear end pretty quickly. But I thought that rhetoric would be kind of an interesting thing to study. And I really enjoyed a lot of my doctoral program, or a lot of my master's program. And it was great because I was offered a teaching assistantship. So I taught some classes, and as a result, I didn't have to pay for my master's, which was huge. And at the end of it, though, I didn't love the culture of academics, and I had such a different experience as a student at Colby College than plenty of my students were having at the University of Colorado at Boulder, that I sort of, I don't know, maybe I was kind of a little Pollyanna-ish about it, but it just sort of felt like, you know, I had been ski bumming and I had been cooking to finance that, and I just found myself missing the kitchen and missing doing, like, physical things with my hands. And the writing and reading was great, but I found myself kind of antsy and doing a lot of like braising and baking all the way through grad school. And I had a meal at a restaurant that I ultimately ended up working at with my parents halfway through my program, and I just thought, like, I was looking at the cooks and I just thought, like, I miss doing that. Those guys are really lucky. I miss being in a kitchen. And so I was offered a spot on the PhD track, but I ultimately, or I was encouraged to apply, but I ultimately decided not to, because I just didn't like the life that much. I didn't want to be having that conversation for the rest of my life.
How did you make it back to Maine?
I learned, I felt like I learned really everything that I could at my cooking job in Boulder, Colorado. And I had lived in Portland in the past. I was born in Portland. I went to college in Maine. I used to, you know, my parents used to bring us up here when we were kids. And, you know, I always loved Maine. I knew I wanted to come back. And my folks at the time lived in New Hampshire. And I've always been kind of a curmudgeonly Yankee at heart. And, you know, all my ski buddies were like guys from Vermont, guys from New Hampshire. And I don't know, I just sort of knew I was sort of destined to return to New England. And Chef Rob from Hugo's had put a Craigslist ad up looking for a fish cook at Hugo's. And I'd been following what he had been doing at Hugo's and was really excited about sort of the food and his approach. And I thought, you know, I think my Colorado time is over. And I wrote a really pompous cover letter talking about how I longed to return to my natal state and wear flannel proudly. And I think Rob read it and showed it to Arlen, and they were like, who the hell is this guy? And I came in and ate a meal at Hugo's, and then I staged a few days later, and I thought the meal was fantastic. I was just blown away by the food. I just thought I could learn so much here. And then I staged in the kitchen and worked with Andrew, and we got along really well right out of the gates. And yeah, they offered me a job, and so I moved back here.
After having been nominated twice, you won the James Beard Award this past spring. Any initial thoughts on this? I know it's pretty early on.
Well, you know, the first year I sort of thought, well, this is like a clerical error. This is ridiculous. That, I mean, that's so flattering, but I don't, it's got to be some kind of fluke or something. And then the second year it sort of felt like I wasn't surprised when we didn't win, but I sort of allowed myself to think like, oh, this could actually be a possibility. And then this year I just sort of tried not to think about it at all. This was the first year where Andrew and I were actually like, okay, what are we going to say if we win? So if that's any indication of how seriously we took it the previous 2 years. Yeah, I was just, more than anything, I was just so happy that I wouldn't be going back and sitting in that theater and wondering, like, going back and forth between trying not to hope that I'm going to win and then, like, not like beating myself up for wanting to win, and then just trying to, like, all the hemming and hawing and stomach churning acidity and all that stuff. I was just really, really thankful that I wasn't gonna be in that position again. And and I also thought, like, wow, this, I hope this helps with staffing. You know, we can put up a Craigslist ad and say, like, James Beard Award winning chef is seeking da 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 da. So those honestly were my initial thoughts when we won. And that Andrew and I were separated, and he had to go down one aisle, and I had to go down the other. And I was like, God, I'm going to have to, like, hustle to time it right. I don't know why, but that seemed really important at the time. And I did. If you see the footage, I hustled. You know, I felt like I looked good. It was good. It was important. Lively and energetic. But, yeah, no, it's great. It's huge. It's kind of the big award to win, and it still doesn't. It doesn't exactly feel real, but it's an incredible honor and, yeah, big responsibility.
Well, I know that you've been incredibly busy, and I know that taking the time to come in here today really is, it's been a commitment for you, but I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's my pleasure.
I've been speaking with Mike Wiley, who is one of the partners with Big Tree Hospitality. And as we've been saying, 2017 James Beard Award winner. Keep up the good work, and I hope we see you back in here again at some point.
Thank you.